Il-program li ser tisimaw uwa miġju plilkom bixuqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavalleri, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm privileged to have with me today on University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Russell Smith, who has recently joined the University of Malta at the Centre for Entrepreneurship and Business Incubation. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Smith began his career in business by starting an electronics company while still studying for his PhD in the early 80s. Products from that company were promoted by the British Council and sold in 27 different countries worldwide. In 1986, he joined the pharmaceutical industry, running drug development programs for major pharmaceutical companies in North America, Europe, Japan, finally leading a team of more than 100 staff. Since 1998, Professor Smith has worked primarily with start-up businesses, including bioscience spin-outs from the University of Oxford. In 2012, he received the prestigious Queen's Award for Enterprise Promotion, which was announced in the Birthday Honours List. He has founded or co-founded numerous new businesses and still managed to find time to develop the Business for Bioscience Internet-Delivered Management course of Oxford Brookes University. He then left to lead Prolysis Limited, another University of Oxford spin-out, as chief executive officer, in a turnaround exercise. Professor Smith later became chairman and non-executive director of other companies and was director of Venture Fest Limited, which I'm sure he will mention during our chat. In 2007, he led, as chairman, the launch of Oxford Expression Technologies from Oxford Brookes University. He founded Business Boffins Limited in order to create an educational program for small business owners, and that program has now become an accredited university course that offers the new Certificate in Small Business Management. Professor Smith wrote a monthly page on business for The Independent, and his book, How to Start a Successful Business, was published in 2007. He has lectured extensively at universities in England and at the University of Malta on undergraduate and postgraduate programs that he has developed. His recent invited lecture tours outside the UK include Chile, Spain, Cyprus, Iceland, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Italy and Malta. My goodness, you have been around. Professor Smith now specializes in the commercialization of intellectual property arising from academic research. In 2015, he delivered training programs for the University of Oxford at the Royal Academy of Engineering to groups of senior academics from India, Vietnam, South Africa, Mexico and Thailand. He was appointed professor in entrepreneurship at the University of Malta in 2015. The bio was lengthy by radio standards, but of course only an outline, I'm sure, of your activities. However, with it, the audience have a chance to get to know you better, even if it's just a very small soundbite. Welcome to the programme, Professor Smith.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much, and thank you for the lovely introduction. I hardly recognise myself.
Before you started your career in business, as we saw, you were actually a neurophysiologist.
Yes.
In your introductory lecture, which can be seen on YouTube, on the UOM channel, I might say, you explain in some way how you moved across the academic map into business. You spoke about the commonalities between ancient beings and ourselves. Can you tell us some of your thoughts on the reasons why human beings have been so successful from the time that really we were still hunter-gatherers?
Well, it seems to me that there's been a vogue in recent years with the buzzword being entrepreneurship, as if that was something special, something new, and something possibly invented by academics about 25 years ago. I really don't think that that is the case. It seems to me that one of the cornerstones of people who are entrepreneurial is their ability to communicate and to take an idea and take it forward and turn it into a product or a service, because there's only two things you can sell in business, a product or a service, and to persuade people as to the benefits of their solution to solve the problem, I think requires a lot of communication. So communication is part of it. But I think imagination is the key. That's the sort of secret behind innovation and having good ideas and the ability to persuade people to your point of view. It occurs to me that, you know, if one thinks about bees, not uncommon to this island, Apis mellifera, the production of honey, etc., they're very, very clever in terms of how they communicate just outside the hive with each other to help bees go off and locate the flowers and gather the pollen. And it takes about a million trips to a flower to get, you know, half a kilo of honey or something. It's quite extraordinary. And the communication is very sophisticated and very good. And they can function very effectively in that way as a community. However, what I think distinguishes us, Homo sapiens sapiens, is that we don't say there's food over there. We say there might be food over there. And it's that imagination and let's go find out, that sort of urge to discover and to try something different and something new and to put a plan together to do it. I've no doubt that before, whenever it was, 70, 80,000 years ago, man began to sort of wander all over the world, there was reasons for doing that, and there were some objectives, and there was plans to do that. What will we need for the journey? How will it work? Well, to be honest, if you take the core of that, it's a business plan. And what do we need to get the job done? It's a budget. I mean, for them, it might have been in seeds or nuts or meat or whatever, but it's the same principle. So I don't think we've been entrepreneurial recently by doing anything different. I think we've just applied how we are. And that's exciting, I think. We are naturally entrepreneurial is my starting point.
I have a little bit of training in archaeology, so I'm always interested in this connection with ancient peoples. And I was listening recently to a lecture by Dr. Gianmarco Alberti, who was talking about Middle Bronze Age in the Aeolian Islands. And he said that there was one building which stood out amongst the rest. And from what they found in that building, it really looked as though it was a place which would be very familiar to us today, a long trestle table, food on the table, the community getting together, sitting across each other, communicating and planning what they were going to do with the next harvest or how they were going to get better food or just that knitting of the community. And I think that's what came across in your talk, that the necessity that people talk to each other.
I think you make a very astute observation, and I think the kind of design of the long table, or whether it's the round table of King Arthur in sort of mythology, is really interesting, because for me, it's not just about communication and decision-making, it's about sharing ideas, and I think that people naturally get together to share ideas. We have a fascination for stories when we're children, and I remember my grandfather telling me stories very clearly, of which my favourite one was about the comet, Halley's Comet. I think you're supposed to pronounce it Hawley's Comet now, but Halley's Comet that comes around every 76 years. And I remember as a slightly older man reminding him about telling me about the stars and things, and it was at the time when Halley's Comet came round, and I said to him, "What do you think about the comet, Grandad?" And he said, "Not as good as last time, son," which I think is a rather nice sort of memory of him. But it's about, you know, the context and the telling of stories and imagination and journeying to the stars or whatever. So I think that people tell stories. I think they naturally tell stories, whether those are, you know, we're well aware of tremendous oral history of the people from Australia that goes back, I believe, about 10,000 years. But storytelling was our primary means of communication, and very important too, if you're going to survive in what is quite a difficult world. So I think those places were for storytelling and sharing ideas. Later, you then have to decide, well, which of those ideas are we going to pick? And that may be a more formal setting, it may be a different thing, but I genuinely believe that a lot of those places that were created, those spaces, were for sharing ideas and telling stories. I just wished I could have been there.
I wish I could close my eyes sometimes and find myself there as well. You list in this talk that you gave and in other materials that I've seen, that you list the requirements for entrepreneurship.
Yes.
In a way, you've just been describing them. Research, planning, training, leadership, communication, management. And you do something which I like very much. You sort of break everything up into bite-sized chunks. And you try and put across these principal points. And also, you try to do that to very different audiences, I gather. That you're interested in the high-flying businessman or businesswoman, but you're also interested in attracting to entrepreneurship people who would normally possibly not think of themselves as entrepreneurs, or even people who feel that they are unable even to keep going in their normal life?
Well, I genuinely believe that the kind of famous 80-20 rule typically applies. Whatever type of business you're looking at, 80% of the things you have to do are broadly the same categories, topics. 20% is going to be adjusted according to what you're doing. So whether it is Professor Clever with a new cure for cancer, or it's some disabled person who works from home because they have to, and runs a business doing some sort of service industry or whatever, the basics are going to be the same. And I think, first of all, you can break it down. Now, I come from a long, I guess the name Smith is a bit of a clue, but I come from a long line of engineers. And there, I think, it's very straightforward that you break something down into a series of components and figure out how it all fits together and works properly, and that's what engineers do. And for me, they are the kind of king in society, in that they take technology and turn it into something useful for society. Could be a bridge, it could be a tablet. But the same process and principles apply. Now, if you look at what the core elements are, first of all, I think it's research. It's about finding things out. And then it's about recognizing that there's some kind of problem. That's the key. And then, having identified a problem, coming up with some kind of solution. That's the imagination component. And then from that, coming up with a plan as to how you're going to provide your solution to a number of people in order to solve their problem. And so there are some various sensible, straightforward steps that people can go through. And in those terms, it's really possible for people from any age group and walks of life to do that. I had the privilege in the UK of being involved with the scouting movement, and I did for the Cubs aged 7 to 9 their entrepreneur's badge. I've never met a more ruthless group of entrepreneurs in my life. They're fantastic. But the idea of, here's a problem, let's think about this and have fun dreaming up an idea, and then let's see if we can apply that idea to solve a problem, just came naturally. And how do you communicate that to them? How do you market it? Well, they tell stories. They just had fun with it. And so we lose something of that. And we have to get people, I think, stop them being too businesslike and being too serious, because they miss out on the sheer joy of doing this kind of thing. Now, the other interesting aspect is that a lot of people are very entrepreneurial and very businesslike in their approach to life, but don't realize it. A really good case in point is my own mother. She's in her 80s, bless her, and lives on her own, looks after herself, and she does research. She has a long list of things she has to do, which is stick onto the fridge with a magnet, and she has them in a priority, and she knows what she's going to budget for doing these various things and when they have to be done, so there's kind of planning all of that. She certainly communicates to those people who need to know what they have to do as well to meet her needs. So there is an element of just normal everyday life, and so I think a lot of people can do these things, and we don't need to dress it up with language that can be a bit off-putting. So we don't need, I don't think, we need things like, you know, value proposition. What does that mean? What are you going to sell? And what's the benefit for the person? And end-to-end ideation. What does that mean? So I think just simple, real language of real people, I think, gets us a long way. And we found that from a program we put together, deliberately designed for people who'd gone off the tracks a bit. And it was designed for underprivileged people who were being quite entrepreneurial, but dealing in illegal products. There was certainly good planning, good organization, good distribution networks, but not necessarily on the right side of the track. So, yes, I think you can put these things together in a straightforward way using real language for real people and make a difference. And I'm afraid we've been saying that for a long time, and we were challenged to prove it. So we did. So we took 150 companies who were starting a business on January the 1st, or just after, at the beginning of 1 year, and we ran them through our program over a year, provided them with the information that we'd sort of distilled, with a reading requirement of no more than one page per day. So not a huge amount, not textbooks. And at the end of that period, we then decided to continue with a 5-year follow-up. And what we found, to our delight and astonishment, is that we had halved the business failure rate over that period of time, just by providing very simple information, straightforward language, in a relatively common sense way, and without requiring them to do a huge amount other than have a plan and a budget. That was the key thing, that they had to have a plan and a budget. So I think that getting the basics right is really important, and therefore it seems to me that you can present that in different ways to different groups, and we've done that now to we certainly work with the academics, so the commercialization of IP, but it's just good ideas. In the same way that, you know, people from other walks of life will have just good ideas, and how do I turn those into something that may be a product or a service that people want to buy? So the principles, honestly, very, very similar. Let's not overcomplicate it. Let's get the basics right. We can be clever later. You know, enterprise first, learn the process, entrepreneurship later.
We tend to think of entrepreneurship in the sort of the digital world and, yes, and that kind of thing. Mm. Whereas in actual fact, there are so many other entrepreneurial, yeah, projects that, yeah, are in very different spheres. I mean, you mentioned, I was quite shocked by the amount that you quoted, the statistic about carers in Britain, I think 6 million.
Six million, indeed.
And some of them actually young, who really need certain product, certain help that perhaps they can get through people who have ideas.
Well, it's quite sort of shocking, really. But the research that we did showed that there were significant numbers of people who probably would benefit from becoming more enterprising, running a business from home in a more efficient way, a more successful way, because they had no choice. And whilst one may think about disabled people, and there are 8 million of those in the UK, there are 6 million carers, and many of them are young people. And those young people don't get the opportunity to get the best out of education. They don't have the privilege that I had to go through a system of education, or indeed people on this island supported with stipend through higher education. They just have to do the best they can. And, you know, the famous phrase is, "Sorry, sir, I couldn't do my homework last night. I had to look after mum." And, you know, what's going to come first? Well, guess what? You know, real life comes first. And so I think we have to think of ways of helping people like that and how we can do it. So it was a struggle, but genuinely the internet and email has changed everything. And we found that by sending things into their home, so 7-page attachment once a week, with a reading requirement of a page a day. And if you don't get a chance to read that, here's a summary of points that you ought to think about. They can cope. And we even had one wonderful guy who could not read. And my colleague mentored him through the whole program, and it was a great success. And his girlfriend read it to him, a page a day. Fantastic. So, you know, we don't need to be thinking about traditional forms of academic study. What we've got to do is to communicate. And, you know, I think in the past, if we think about telling stories, you know, how long would they last? Well, then they weren't textbook length. You know, there would be the attention span of a young person. It's probably a few pages. So we seem to have hit the spot there in terms of what people could keep up with and they felt comfortable with. And therefore, I think that, in all honesty, every person from every walk of life needs to think a little differently about what they do. And I certainly encourage our students to do that. So let me give you an explanation. I don't know whether you or your listeners have seen the film The Matrix, but I use that with my students as being an illustration. The Matrix is, to me, like employment. It's a complete illusion. The real world is not like that. I don't really understand why we sign up to work 9 to 5, except for the convenience of others. And I'm shocked that it is legal and not illegal to enter into an agreement with somebody that you'll pay them the same amount every month, no matter how hard they work, no matter how successful they make your business. Surely that's exploitation or something. It's abuse, isn't it? We can't do that, surely. But apparently some people do. So I suggest to students, look, you go through this process, a lot of effort and hard work, to acquire intellectual property. You're not a patent, but you are a business unit. You as a human being are a business unit. And you're going to sell knowledge, your know-how, those things that people might call trade secrets or whatever, but you'll have loads of that to sell, and there will be people interested in buying it. And often they're called employers, and often you foolishly enter into a contract with just one employer. Now, other people, other academics who go down a discipline of, say, law or accountancy, they're fully familiar with the idea of having more than one client, and, you know, and do that routinely without thinking about it. So why not be a little bit more like that? First of all, thinking, should I just have one client or multiple clients? And then if you have multiple clients, how can you think about sharing in the profit of whatever you're doing? And then further, if you really want to be entrepreneurial, what about selling the company or having more than one company? So it's just about opening up possibilities. But, and it's a big but, if you find the dream job that you love, do it. That's the key. It's very rare to see the word happiness in business school textbooks, which I think is a mistake. So you've got to be happy in all of this. Because I must warn you, if you ever do start your own business, you'll never have a more difficult boss. And you will be working 7 days a week sometimes, and you'll be working, you know, 24 hours a day sometimes. So you need to just widen the horizon a little, and not just focus on a job, but think about how to get the best return on your investment, because all students are investors. Time, money, and effort is really, really important. And how best to get a return on that? Employment, yes, but not just employment. Just think a little broader.
I think what you're saying is also trying to change a mindset. And that is probably the most difficult thing to do, really, in any organisation.
No, you're right. And I think you make a really important point, especially in academia. I would talk about entrepreneurial type things 20 years ago at Oxford and maybe get half a dozen people in a room. In fact, I think the worst session ever was two people, one of whom was the student's tutor. So it was just, you know, one. But after a few years, it gradually built up and built up and built up. And the interest sort of grew in all of that, such that the student society of entrepreneurs in Oxford now numbers 10,500 students, which is the biggest society of students in Europe, I gather. So it's really grown out of proportion. But the mindset, I think, is in both directions, both the academics and the students. The students are now creating pull-through, being interested in that and thinking about how they can use the knowledge that they acquire in a more entrepreneurial way. To some extent, let's be honest, the fact that we have to pay student tuition fees in the UK has driven people to think about how to get a return on that investment a little more. But nevertheless, I think in the academic side of things, amongst the teaching staff, etc., in my field, which is medical research, many people got into medical research because they wanted to make a difference, not make a dollar. So it's difficult, but I've been persuaded to this, and I think the best story to persuade one is around penicillin. You know, great thing that happened, 1942, fantastic, but 2 years later there was resistance seen in the clinic, and we now have big problems with resistance to antibiotics. There was no patent, there was no revenue from that for the university, so it couldn't do follow-on research. So it's all about bringing money into the university to do more of what it's good at. And what it's good at is thinking and providing solutions, new ideas to problems. And I think whether that's in an area of Icelandic saga poetry, which I know nothing about, but I defend to the death the right of people to do research, or whether it's in medicine, across the board, I think we have to bring funds into the university to let it do what it does best, which is find out things that are interesting and help young people become interested in everything.
Just in the last few minutes that we have, perhaps we can talk about University of Malta. You've actually moved from UK to Malta. I gather some of your colleagues were slightly surprised by this move, but you did give them a good answer, didn't you?
Well, I think there's an inevitable curiosity about why I move from the UK to Malta, and there's an arrogance about the British approach to that, perhaps, which I have to say, admit to. But it's a fair question too, so why do that? And one of the things was the exciting programme that we've developed here, the Master in Entrepreneurship programme, which mimics the process of setting up a high-tech, high-growth company in real life and culminates at the end of it with your Viva being a funding presentation. The whole thing is geared to a real-life situation. So I thought that's really enterprising and entrepreneurial. I was delighted to be invited to design and deliver that. So having now been here, I think this is my 19th trip over the last 3 years. It got to the point where I just don't want to go back. Let's do more. So we've been thinking about all sorts of things at the university that we could do, developing the MEnt into a DEnt, a doctorate in entrepreneurship, how we could work with good ideas coming through the university, working with people who want to incubate their ideas. So lots of ideas and a very sort of pro-entrepreneurial approach. So I'm here, and the simple answer is, to be honest, I was lucky to be asked.
Thank you for that compliment for the university. Here we have what we familiarly refer to as CEBI, which is the Centre for Entrepreneurship and Business Incubation. So that's a sort of the academic
side of it. Yes. We've got the course, the, as you say, the master's course, and perhaps that can also be developed. But we also have Takeoff, which is the incubator. So you see an advantage in having one and the other in the same place in the university. Do you think that the university is a good place to have an incubator? I picked up a statistic somewhere, I think there are about 800 worldwide incubators actually attached to universities. Obviously, there are many others which are not. But is there an advantage?
Well, the answer is a resounding yes, and I'd even broaden it out further. My particular area of interest is the commercialization of intellectual property arising from academic research. A big mouthful, what does it mean? How to turn good ideas from researchers into products and services. Now, do we want researchers to be turned into business people? No. They like research, they're good at it, and they invent things. Let's keep doing that. But we need world-class managers to support that. So I think we need to have a knowledge transfer office that allows us to commercialise IP and help bring money back into the university and to the inventors to help support them do more of what they enjoy doing. Now, whether that's more research, to some extent drinking cocktails in the Bahamas, or whatever it is, it doesn't really matter, but we need a process to help achieve that. So that's one side. Now, if you create a business, that's going to be a fairly limited amount of development. Majority of ideas will be sold or licensed, but if you create a business, then you need to have help there, and you need to have help from people who've done it before. So it's not a textbook thing. It's going to be different for every business, and so you've got to have an incubator where people are able to provide advice, and they've done it many times before. So grey hair is good. Just the years and the experience and I think is important, and not to try and turn it into a textbook situation. So yes, marrying the academic rigour of what underpins good advice and how it works with the ability to communicate and to help people at a point in time. The other hand of steadying the tiller so that the boat doesn't go off course, and reassurance and so forth, I think comes from the ability to say, yes, I have done this before, don't worry, this is what I would think you should do. So all of those things work together very well. So the knowledge, I think, the experience, if you couple that with the ideas which the university generates in bucketfuls, and then have then a mechanism to assess how to commercialise it, and if you want to create a company, which not all will do, but if you want to do that, then to have full support is really, really important. And I think it's a terrific idea.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. I'd like to thank you, Professor Russell Smith, for coming to talk to us on University Matters today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.